Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Today is the birthday of naturalist John Muir. My guest, Raymond Barnett, says John Muir was also an accidental Taoist. Retired Chico State professor Ray Barnett studied Chinese language and graduated magna cum laude in Chinese history at Yale University. He studied theology for a year at New York City's Union Theological Seminary, then served a year with the U.S. Army in Vietnam. After earning a Ph.D. in evolutionary ecology from Duke University, Professor Barnett taught in the biology department at Chico State for 30 years. For helping found Chico's Gateway Science Museum, he was named Father of the Museum after retiring from Chico State. Among the books of fiction and nonfiction that Raymond Barnett has written are Relax, You're Already Home, Jade and Fire, The China Ultimatum, and The Return to Treasure Island. His latest book is Earth Wisdom, John Muir, Accidental Taoist, Charts Humanity's Only Future on a Changing Planet. Ray Barnett, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy.
You know, I mentioned that you had your undergraduate degree from Yale University, and I thought it was interesting that John Muir got an honorary degree from your alma mater.
Yes, he did, thereby showing their wisdom and their appreciation.
Well, I saw so many links between you and John Muir. I would imagine that you identified with him.
I did quite a bit in that we both love wilderness and go backpacking a lot. However, he was immensely stronger and luckier in the wilderness than I've ever been, actually.
Well, I don't think there are many people ever who were as strong as he was.
I agree. Not, you know, in terms of bulk. He was always a wiry fellow, but he could spend literally weeks out and many days out in the wilderness with no food whatsoever before he had to come back and get his stash of bread to take back out again.
Yeah, that amazed me that he was able to do that.
I agree.
And then when he met his future in-laws, they saw, oh, this poor guy, we've got to feed him.
Yes. They found him at the tail end of an incredible fall after many, many weeks on first the Sacramento River and then the Merced and San Joaquin River. And he was literally a scarecrow when he ambled into their ranch house. He must not have looked too bad, though, because their daughter married him 2 years later.
And she could have had married other men who asked her.
Yes.
And she turned them down.
Yeah, she saw what was inside Muir for sure.
Well, it seems that you are uniquely qualified to write this book.
Perhaps, yes.
And I'm so glad you did. I really enjoyed. There were things about John Muir that I'd learned that I'd never suspected. I just found it such an interesting story of his life and what he did and what kind of person he was.
I agree. That was one of the surprises to me was that, I mean, we all know John Muir, the mountain man in the Sierra Nevadas, but before he got to the Sierra Nevadas, he'd walked 1,000 miles from Indiana to Florida, just a scant 2 years after the end of the Civil War, which is not a great time to be wandering around the South. And then after the Sierra Nevada, he spent many wonderful adventures in Alaska. And Alaska was actually his passion the last, say, decade and a half or two decades of his life. And that's stuff that we're not generally aware of, I don't think.
No, I didn't know all about his treks through the South. And what I enjoyed was the fact that he was keeping a journal. And so he was an eyewitness to these things. We don't have to take somebody else's word for what the generals were doing. He was in contact with the average person. He avoided cities, in fact. So when we get his eyewitness reactions to what it was like to walk through the South.
I think it's a wonderful sociological study. It's an historical document. Because as you say, he wasn't talking to the movers and shakers. He was talking to the Negro teamsters, to the black and white people who were wandering around the countryside. And he saw something that historians just don't see. And he recorded it all in his ever-present journal.
Well, I'd like to skip over to, this is at the very end of part one of your book. And you say that John Muir's original contributions to the scientific understanding of botany, geology, and the grand dualistic ecological cycles creating landscape all this comes together in a form, to form a coherent worldview new to the Western tradition. So you're saying here's this guy that is coming up with something that is new to us here in the West. But I'd like you, if you don't mind, Ray, on page 76 in your book, if you would read the two paragraphs, your two concluding paragraphs of part one. And this is where John Muir came to a new understanding, which is new to us in the West.
Sure, Nancy. If we had to name Muir's new understanding of the way things are, perhaps earth wisdom would be most appropriate. To be sure, others have realized pieces of Muir's earth wisdom. Heraclitus, St. Francis of Assisi, Alexander von Humboldt, Albert Schweitzer. None before him, though, articulated the same stunning breadth and depth of insight to create a seamless whole, a way of approaching the world, of living in the world, as exuberantly and prodigiously as Muir. None in the Western tradition, that is. Because as I read Muir's life and writings, time and again a thought tugs at the corner of my mind. This sounds strangely like, that reminds me of. Unbidden, as a distraction, Muir's thoughts and actions constantly pulled me eastward, far eastward, across North America, across the Atlantic, across Eurasia to a land and culture thousands of years old when Muir immigrated to America. Muir's earth wisdom, new as a coherent whole to the West, is in fact old in the East.
My guest is Raymond Barnett, and he's just been reading from his new book, Earth Wisdom. And you mentioned that this, if we had to name, give a name to Muir's understanding of the way things are, that you suggest earth wisdom would be an appropriate label.
Well, certainly. He was he knew the earth extremely well. He spent so much time in the wilderness. And as I say over and again in the book, he traveled with eyes wide open and his mind wide open. He saw things that other people didn't see, and he was able to understand and appreciate what he saw. And strangely enough, is this habit of traveling with your eyes and your mind wide open that explains why he was, in fact, an accidental Taoist, because that's the way the Taoist operated in China 3,000 years ago. They had the same methodology, so to speak, so that when they look at the world, they see the same thing and describe the same thing that Muir does, because they're both looking with eyes and minds wide open.
Well, I mentioned that you're uniquely qualified to write a book like this because, and I also mentioned that you studied Chinese language and Chinese history at Yale University as an undergraduate. And so you had this background in philosophy like the Tao Te Ching.
I suppose so. And I've read quite a bit of Taoism. That first, one of my first books that you mentioned, Relax Your Already Home, is actually a primer on the Taoist tradition or the Taoist way of life. So, yeah, it's been on my mind for many years. Although while I was at Yale, I just read the stuff. I didn't appreciate it. I mean, I've often said, what can a 22-year-old know, really? I was just too young, didn't understand things, didn't have enough life hit me between the eyes yet to fully appreciate the wisdom of the Taoist tradition. But then as you get knocked around by life, you come to understand that, wow, these folks really know where it's at and they know what's going on. So that by the time I read Muir, which was really I only started reading Muir's journals, oh, maybe a decade and a half ago, if that. But at any rate, by the time I picked his journals up and started looking at something beyond the sort of ecology movement Muir that just has two or three of his famous sayings about going to the mountains is going home and that sort of stuff. Once you get beyond those little tidbits of Muir and read his journals particularly, then you really see how well he's describing the world. And in fact, that he's got a worldview that is coherent and makes a lot of sense.
Well, you know, I was intrigued by the fact, and this is a separate story. Maybe you write your autobiography, right? But here you are from Tulsa, Oklahoma,
yeah.
And you go off to Yale and study Chinese language and history. And I can't, how did you get interested in that subject?
You'll regret asking me that. But I was originally into, you know, philosophy and literature. And in my junior year, I had my schedule all made out. I needed a class that met Monday, Wednesday, Friday at noon to fit into my schedule. And I thumbed through the book, and it was Chinese history, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at noon. And better yet, it didn't require a term paper. So I took that class, and as they say, the rest is history. It was so new. I mean, every course you take in Western history, you really know what's going to happen. You know who's going to win the wars and all that sort
You've
of stuff.
You've grown up with that history.
Exactly. But Chinese history was completely new, and their cultural traditions just seemed to strike a chord with me, even though, as I've indicated, I didn't really understand them very well then. But it did seem to strike a chord with me. And so I, even though I went on to get my PhD in science, I've been sort of in love with the Chinese culture ever since, and made trips to China and all that sort of stuff as well.
My guest is Ray Barnett. He's written several books. One of his first books was about the Tao Te Ching. That wasn't in the title. And his newest book is Earth Wisdom, and he refers to John Muir as an accidental Taoist. And I just ask you about how you happened to end up majoring in what you did, rather unusual circumstances. And I was interested in how John Muir, here he is, a Midwesterner, he goes to the University of Wisconsin, and why did he suddenly get this crazy notion to go on a 1,000-mile walk down through the South and right after the Civil War?
Well, right after the Civil War was just when it happened to be, but and it was a crazy time to be wandering around the South. And people over and over told him on his walk, you know, John, you can't do this because you're going to get yourself killed. And he, in some ways, he had very little common sense. But the reason he was taking the walk was that while he was at the University of Wisconsin, he took a class in botany and other classes, including geology classes. Well, the botany and geology he loved. And he couldn't – he was sort of bored in college. He wanted to go out and have adventures. But he was in love with botany. And he went botanizing in Canada for several years, and he knew the plants around the upper Midwest.
Yeah, there's a new verb for me, botanizing. he went botanizing.
Yes, that's a
but
very
I'll
well –
But you do that.
It's a very well-used verb, yes. But he didn't know anything about the subtropical and tropical plants. So he decided after he'd had an accident in a carriage factory in Indiana where a file flipped over as he was tightening a belt and pierced his eye and he lost his sight for several weeks. He thought, no more factory work for me.
Because he didn't know if he would get the sight back.
No, at the time he thought he wasn't going to get the sight back in that one eye. Although he did.
So he says, I'm going to make a change in my life.
Yes. He said, I want to go look at the inventions of God and not the inventions of man. And by that, he meant the natural world. And because he didn't know anything about subtropical and tropical plants, he decided he was going to walk from Indiana to the Gulf of Mexico and then board a boat, get to South America, and raft down the Amazon and see the tropical plants in the Amazon. Well, thank goodness, by the time he got to Florida, he was flat on his back for 3 months with malaria because, as you indicated, he slept outside about half the nights in the South. And, of course, you're going to get bit by mosquitoes and probably catch malaria, which he did. But it had weakened his iron constitution a bit. And he was not sure whether it was a good idea to go down the Amazon. And most fortunately for us, he couldn't find a boat to South America, and the only ship he could find was one that would take him to California. And so he ended up in California and discovered the Sierra Nevada, and the rest is history.
Well, you mentioned that he did a lot of sleeping outdoors, and yet he didn't take a jacket or an overcoat, a blanket. He had, well, today we'd call it a backpack. It was a shoulder bag. And I was surprised that he could get by with so little. But I, because I've done pilgrimage a lot, I know you can get by with a very few items. But one thing I didn't haul around was a plant press.
Yeah. Yeah, he had a plant press on his back. He was a very serious botanist, and he was good friends with all the leading botanists in the United States immediately after the Civil War. And he discovered plants that he sent to the Harvard Arboretum and that got named after him and stuff like that. So a very competent botanist, but just tough as nails. Even not just going through the South in the fall, but in the Sierra Nevadas, on glaciers in Alaska, never took a blanket, never took an overcoat. And he would just make his fire sort of up against a rock and then gather some branches of pine or incense cedar were his favorites, and sleep on that as a bed. And sleep with one side towards the fire until it got cold enough so that it woke him up. Then he'd wake up, replenish the fire, turn around so that the cold side was now facing the fire, and sleep until he woke up again. Even when he was on what was called the Muir Glacier in Alaska, woke up in the middle of a frigid rainstorm, which would soon become a snowstorm. Because it would slow him down, he took off his overcoat that he had in the canoe that he'd hired to take him up the coast of Alaska, and left the overcoat at home because he knew it would slow him down, and then took off for a full day on the glacier, getting sopping wet. He was, as I mentioned, a very strong person. He could take stuff that I couldn't take, certainly. But he lived till 76, so did okay.
And some people think that was premature death.
Well,
that,
yes.
There were other factors involved,
I think so.
In that.
Yes.
Well, he doesn't mention it, and you don't, in the book. The fact that he is from the North means he's going to talk like a Yankee.
Talk funny, yeah.
And right. So when I was reading your book, I thought, well, he must really have been very likable, because when he opened his mouth with that mm-hmm. accent of a Yankee, those Southerners are going to really bristle.
That's a good point, particularly 2 years after the Civil War.
Exactly. Yeah. And even years after the Civil War,
yes.
There's a distrust for Yankees in the South.
That's right. That's a good point, Nancy. I had overlooked that. Good, very good point.
Well, I had a friend who was from the South, but he was going to the University of Michigan. And when he would come home for vacation with those Michigan plates on his car, he had to make sure he said something so they could say, oh, it's okay. This guy's not a troublemaker. Because during the 60s, a lot of people from the North did come down and make trouble. So I just thought, gosh, that's another compliment to John Muir that he could get along at a time when Northerners were highly distrusted. My guest is Ray Barnett, and his newest book is Earth Wisdom. And it's about John Muir, who... Professor Barnett says there are a lot of parallels with Taoism. Now, one other thing that he is not too crazy about organized religion, and when he was in the South and he saw the palmetto, this plant that he hadn't seen before, and he seemed to get more information from this plant than he did from a human priest.
Yes. He was fond of making fun of how little he learned from ministers and priests. Yes.
And he did have a sense of humor. I mean, his journal is funny.
Yes. Yes. Most definitely.
Well, you mentioned that due to the fact that he's stymied about his trip that he was going to go to South America and he gets malaria. So off he goes to California. And he has a friend named Jean Carr. And she introduces him to Ralph Waldo Emerson.
Yeah.
And Emerson was quite impressed with John Muir. To what extent? How do we know how impressed Emerson was?
Well, Emerson spent some time in Yosemite. Muir wanted him to go camping with him in the Mariposa Grove of giant sequoias. But Emerson was fairly old by this time, so he had all of these handlers around him, you know, who said, no way you're going to be sleeping outside all night. And so they didn't let him. But even though he was had just spent several days with Muir talking with him, when he got back to Boston and then outside of Boston, to Concord, he had a short list of what he called my men. And these were people whom he'd met in his life that he thought were head and shoulders above everyone else. And these were extremely prominent writers and judges and politicians and everything. And when he had met Muir, Muir was a sawyer. He was sawing up downed black oak trees in Yosemite Valley. So when he got home to Concord, Emerson made the last entry on his list of my men, and it was John Muir, who really stuck out on that list, but has since it's been proved that he was right in his evaluation, certainly.
Yeah, this list of men that he greatly admired, that Emerson admired. In fact, Emerson even offered Muir a job.
Oh, yeah. He thought Muir was just the man to edit Henry David Thoreau's writings. So he invited him to Boston and said he could get him a job in a museum, a library, editing Thoreau and coming out with the definitive Thoreau. And he thought Muir was just the man because he, like Thoreau, really understood the natural world. But Muir understood that was not a job that was to his likings, and he wrote a letter to Emerson saying, I'm going to stick here and listen to the waterfalls and listen to the bird songs and get as close to the heart of the world as I can. And I just love that. He understood the heart of the world wasn't in libraries or museums. The heart of the world was outside in the natural world. Even though he got along famously with people, he was quite clear where the heart of the world really resided.
You know what, too? Emerson recognized that Muir would be a good person to edit Thoreau's papers. And I thought it was interesting that Thoreau was greatly influenced by Eastern thought himself.
Yeah, yeah, he was. And that's the interesting thing. Thoreau is an extremely intellectual, well-read man. Muir was, so he'd read a little bit about Chinese philosophy and Eastern philosophy, mainly
Indian.
Indian and Buddhism and Hinduism, things like that. Muir was well-read for a boy who'd grown up on the farm, and he got increasingly well-read as he grew older. But really, he had never read anything about China, certainly never read any Buddhism or Taoism, and really had never thought of China at all. And so to me, this was made it even more intriguing that Muir turned out, in my estimation, to be an accidental Taoist. He got to the same worldview that the Taoists had gotten to several thousand years earlier.
Without getting the information directly from them.
Exactly.
He came to his own conclusions. Now, he did write for national magazines.
Oh, yes.
So he was, even though he might not have read a lot of books, he was a good writer. I mean, his journal, we see that in his journal, and then also in national magazines.
Oh, yeah, the Century Magazine, Scribner's. Back in those days, the 1870s and 80s, magazines were extremely important sources of information for the United States, much more than they are these days. And he was very well known, and the editors all knew him. And throughout the 1870s, he would send back east articles about his adventures in the Sierra Nevada, and they were anxious to hear all they could from John Muir. And again, in those years, he was reading a ton so that he was rapidly bringing himself up to speed and so that he was, as you have mentioned, a very competent botanist as well as a very competent geologist. He was the fellow who figured out that the Sierra Nevada had been sculpted by glacier action, which flew exactly against the prevailing wisdom then by all the PhDs from Harvard and everything.
Well, Ray, we need to take a break. And when we get back, I want to ask you how John Muir came to know the Bidwells and how he came to Chico and why he left.
Certainly.
Why he left Chico. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest today is retired Chico State professor Ray Barnett, and he has written a book, Earth Wisdom, about John Muir, who he says is an accidental Taoist. He didn't set out, it wasn't intentional, but there's so many parallels with John Muir's worldview and the worldview of Taoism. I mentioned that I was going to ask you how John Muir came to know the Bidwells and how he happened to come to Chico.
Well, he was very well known in California by 1877. And many people were very anxious to get Muir to their home. The Stencils in the Alhambra Valley, whose daughter he later married, had a standing invitation for Muir. And the Bidwells did too. And they just very much hoped he would come to visit them. Well, in the late summer of 1877, Muir got back from the San Gabriel Mountains in Southern California to San Francisco and discovered that the Harvard botanist was waiting for him there. And this fellow had worked with Muir before, and so he asked Muir to lead him up to Mount Shasta because he had a very special guest, and that was Joseph Hooker, who was Charles Darwin's best friend in England. And Hooker was in North America and wanted to see the plants. Hooker was a botanist, wanted to see the plants of California. And so he was invited to lead this illustrious group to Mount Shasta. Well, on the way, they stopped in Chico to pick up General Bidwell and Annie because it was on the way, and Annie and General Bidwell were prominent people. So the whole company went up to Shasta, and they botanized in Shasta and had a wonderful time. And then on their way back, the Bidwells insisted that Muir stay at their mansion. And after several days, Muir had spent a lot of time speaking with General Bidwell about trees and plants. General Bidwell got awfully tired of Annie just gushing over John Muir. Annie's sister, or perhaps it was niece, from Washington, D.C., was visiting them.
In the book, you say sister.
Sister, okay, thank you. Her sister was visiting, and she probably hoped that she was going to hook her sister up and get Muir interested in the sister and in honorable matrimonial terms. But evidently, that didn't catch fire. But Annie herself was just quite smitten with Muir. Muir had a magnetic effect on women all his life. Never to inappropriate uses did he put this magnetism, but clearly he was catnip to the ladies. And General Bidwell was getting tired, evidently, of his wife gushing about John Muir. And so when Muir said, you know, I sure like to float down the Sacramento River, Bidwell said, I'll have my carpenter make you a boat. And so he had his carpenter throw together a fairly rough craft, and he immediately escorted Muir down to the landing at Butte City and put him on the boat. And so that's how he got rid of Muir, even though he appreciated Muir as well. And Muir proceeded to float all the way down to the Delta. And when he got to the Delta, he was still having fun. So he got on a train and took it to Visalia. This is all in the fall of 1877. And Clarence King, one of the people who declared that Muir was an ignorant shepherd because he actually thought that glaciers had anything to do with Yosemite Valley, Clarence King had declared that the Kings River Canyon in what we now call Sequoia National Park was inaccessible, which means the man wasn't alive who could hike down that entire canyon. It was too rough. Think of upper Chico Creek in Upper Park and all the big boulders and everything and the difficulty of getting through that. Well, Muir took this as a challenge. He got up to the head of the Kings River Canyon with a young fellow on the train that he'd met, a very young man, and he proceeded over the next 12 days to hop, jump, slide, skip, and occasionally swim down the Kings River Canyon. They ran out of food after 10 days, and Muir had to half carry his 20-year-old companion the last 2 days, but they finally made it to the end, at which case he took a stage to Hopeton, which is on the Merced, and then he made himself another boat from spare lumber from fences, and he floated down the Merced River.
And I feel that's so interesting. He finds some spare boards,
yes,
he has some nails, and he uses a rock as a hammer. Builds himself a boat.
And then he travels another 215 miles floating the Merced to the San Joaquin, and then this is back when the San Joaquin still had water, of course. It doesn't today. But back then, you could float into the San Joaquin River, float up to the Delta, and he got through the Delta, which to my mind is a pretty impressive feat, and got to the junction of the Suisun Bay and San Pablo Bay at what is today Martinez. He hiked through Martinez to the Strentzels ranch there, which is another couple who had been importuning
him.
Who was from Hungary, and got there just in time for Thanksgiving. So they stuffed him with all sorts of meats and fruits and vegetables, and even though he was a scarecrow when he got there. So this was...
This is information from his journal now.
He's saying this. He's describing himself as a scarecrow. Mm-hmm. And then after 2 days, and by the way, this is the daughter of this family that he married 2 years later. After 2 days, he said, thank you, walked the 20 miles to Oakland, took the ferry across to San Francisco and settled in to do some writing. So this was sort of not a typical fall for John Muir, but one that stands out in my mind at any rate.
My guest is retired Professor Raymond Barnett. He's written quite a few books. His most recent is Earth Wisdom, John Muir, Accidental Taoist, Charts Humanity's Only Future on a Changing Planet. You mentioned that he went down the Sacramento River, and I was interested in the name he gave his boat because people today say that the Sacramento River still has those hazards. And what did he name his boat?
Yeah, well, he named the boat Snag Jumper 1. And those of us who've been on the Sacramento River know you got to keep your eyes open for these snags, even today.
In fact, I mentioned this to a friend, and he said he was on the river one day when an employee at Inlo died from getting snagged.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, oh, my gosh.
Yeah, you really got to know what you're doing. And he was the only guy in this boat. And this boat wasn't one of our nice kayaks or canoes that we have these days. It was probably closer to a raft, as a matter of fact.
In fact, you describe in your book that Bidwell had his carpenter build a crude boat.
Yeah, right. The same thing goes going up the San Joaquin. He named that boat that he had hammered together with a rock and some nails and some fence boards. He named that the Snag Jumper 2, and he rode it 215 miles to Martinez. So he was a man who was equally at home on water as he was in the mountains and in glaciers, for that matter, too.
Well, I mentioned when he was walking through the South, he avoided cities as much as possible. He stayed in the forest. And he, at one point in his journal, says that city-bound humans are asleep. And the solution? They should go to a forest or a creek.
Right. Yeah, right. And, of course, many of us agree with that. Not that cities are necessarily bad places, particularly now that you've cleaned up a lot of the pollution and there are parks and things like that. But at even rate, the vibrancy, the life, the sheer joy of living you get from being in the natural world simply can't be matched in a city. And if you're in the city all your life, he says, we cramp our souls the way the Chinese cramp their feet with foot binding. And when we live in cities, and that's probably an apt metaphor, I think.
Well, later in your book, you quote Pope Francis, and he states the problem that the earth, our home, is beginning to look more and more like an immense pile of filth. The degree of human intervention in the natural world, often in the service of business interests and consumerism, is actually making our earth less rich and beautiful, ever more limited and gray. We seem to think we can substitute an irreplaceable and irretrievable beauty with something which we have created ourselves. And so he's sounding like John Muir.
Yeah, well, again, it's people who look at the world with open eyes.
And he said that Francis sounds like, you say in your book, he sounds like Muir, even more so when he considers the world's cities home to half of humanity. So Pope Francis is echoing John Muir, too, and said, cities, you got to get out of those cities and get out in the forest.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I didn't think I would love Pope Francis's environmental encyclical back in the summer of 2015, but it was just so right on. It was surprising.
And another point in his journal, John Muir says, "No sane man, you don't find any sane man in San Francisco.
Yeah.
No sane man in San Francisco."
Yeah, he really thought it befogged you to live in a city all the time. And he could see the vibrancy in the natural world, and he could feel it in his own life, how joyful and exuberant he was when he connected up with this life in the natural world. And so it puzzled him why people should spend so much time in cities. I mean, he understood it. That's where your job is. But he was a lifelong apostle of getting out of those cities and into the natural world. Mountains, if you could, glaciers, rivers, wherever.
And I admired his the fact that he respected life, and when he was in Alaska.
Yeah.
And this guy is shooting a pigeon just for target practice. And
yeah.
John Muir's, please don't do that.
Well, not only please don't do that, it was one of the Tlingit Indians that when he got to Alaska, he was after glaciers. He discovered the first glacier in the Sierra Nevada, and then discovered a lot more after that. But he realized they were residual glaciers. They were baby glaciers left over. So he wanted to get up to real glaciers. So he would take a boat as far north as he could go in Alaska. And this was only 10 or 15 years after the United States had purchased it from Russia. And then he'd typically hire maybe a half a dozen Tlingit Indians and a big canoe to take him as far up north along the coast of Alaska as he could get before the snow hit. And these Indians would shoot food, birds, as you mentioned, and seals from the canoe. And as they would be shooting them from the canoes, Muir would rock the canoe and rock it back and forth so they
couldn't aim at
so they couldn't aim and hit the stuff. I mean, they had plenty of beans and biscuit already stored in the canoes for food, so they didn't really need the meat, but the Indians, and their traditional food was lots of seals, obviously.
And then it sounded like they blamed us.
They blamed us for being so casual about life. And the Indians would turn to Muir and say, "Well, you're right, but we have grown careless with Boston men around us so long." And by Boston men, that was the way they described Americans of the European descent. And they'd seen so many Boston men, so many Euro-Americans killing things needlessly that they had sort of picked up the habit, is what they were telling Muir.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, somebody who felt that way, you'd think, well, he must have been a vegetarian.
Generally, he didn't eat a lot of meat. One of the main reasons, he subsisted almost entirely on bread when he was in the wilderness. Was because it was light, it was easy to carry, and he thought the less meat you ate, probably the better off you were. He also thought it messed up your rucksack if you tried to store meat in it. But nonetheless, for example, when he showed up at the Dr. Strensel's home on Thanksgiving, he took all the meat they could throw at him because he was famished. So he was not ideologically a fierce vegetarian, but he thought, generally speaking, he preferred, for the most part, bread and vegetables and fruit.
My guest is Professor Raymond Barnett. He's retired from the biology department at Chico State, where he taught for 30 years. And also, you were named Father of the Museum. This was the Chico's Gateway Science Museum. And I thought, well, there's another kind of an overlap, because the Gateway Science Museum is a stone's throw from Bidwell Mansion.
Yes. And Muir had been there and stayed several days at the mansion as well. So I think it's a perfect place for a museum, because it's ground that that Muir has trod on. And he and John Bidwell spent a lot of time walking around and looking at Bidwell's orchards and things like that. And in fact, he learned so much from Bidwell that when he married the daughter of Dr. Strensel, Dr. Strensel had several thousand acres in what is now Martinez, mainly orchards. Muir took over the running of the orchards and the ranch, and worked himself to the bone during the 1880s and made a lot of money. He was such a smart, observant fellow that he was just as good at business as he was at anything else. And so by the end of 10 years of running the orchard, he had enough money salted away in various banks in San Francisco and Martinez that he knew that his wife and the two daughters they had were financially set. And so his wife saw what running the orchards and the ranch was doing to Muir. It was cutting him off from the source of his life, really, his time in the natural world. So she told him, John, you need to give up the ranch. You need to let someone else manage it for you, and you need to get back to Alaska, and you need to get back to the Sierra Nevada. What a wonderful wife she was. She really understood Muir.
And because he, when they first knew each other, he would run off to Alaska. He said, sorry, dear, I can't marry you right now. I've got to go to Alaska.
That's right. I need to take a trip to Alaska before the wedding. But she understood this, and she knew that was a Muir she loved. And so he was physically sick, too, by living down in the valley so much. His lungs were never very strong. That's what finally killed him, really, was his lungs filling up. So she could see him getting sick, both physically and spiritually, I guess you would say. So she urged him to drop the ranch, and he realized he'd made enough money for his family. And it didn't take a lot of urging to convince him to get back to his wandering ways. Although this time, I should say, the people back east, particularly Robert Underwood Johnson, an editor of Century Magazine, who knew Muir from all of his writings in the 1870s, latched on to Muir just this time and said, we need your help in the burgeoning conservation movement. And Muir dedicated really the last 20 or 30 years of his life, not just to more or less aimless wanderings, but to wanderings that were specifically keyed to conserving the natural world that he loved so much.
Well, you know, I thought of John Muir's situation, what made him decide, I'm going to take this walk that I want to do because I love botany. And there was a character, Galen Clark, who the doctor said, sorry, but you've only got a year to live.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened there?
Well, Clark, who had done some mining, a fair amount of mining, which is where his lungs got their infection. And as you say, the doctor said, sorry, you don't have long to live.
He was coughing up blood, and he was only 42 years old.
Yes, exactly. So he said, well, you know, I've only got a year. I'm going to go somewhere pretty. So he went to what we now call Wawona, south of Yosemite Valley, and set up a hostel there just to keep himself in bread and meat for his year he had left, for a hostel for travelers getting up to Yosemite from the south. And he started exploring more of the area around there. He discovered the Mariposa Grove not too far from Wawona, and pretty soon people were coming to visit that as well. And Clark discovered John Muir, and they would go on long rambles together. And Muir, in fact, said Clark was the best mountaineer I know, which is a huge compliment from John Muir. And Clark just kept on walking and kept on living up in the mountains, and instead of living 1 year, he lived another 50 years, and he died when he was in his 90s.
And so he almost made it to 96.
Almost 96. Yes, right. So clearly, living in the Sierra Nevadas did wonders.
Was good for
Galen
his health.
Good for his health. Yes, right.
Well, John Muir felt that the mountains were where we thrive, and he certainly did. There were in your book, you talk about the two perfected lords. Who were the two perfected lords?
Well, Wang and Guo. They were from the Taoist tradition in China, and they probably lived in about 600, between 600 and 700 A.D., and they were Taoist ramblers, and they had been told by their teacher that there was a particularly fine spot in the mountains in the south. So they took up their calabashes and their straw hats and took off for Mount Huakai Shan.
Now, I want to pause just for a second, Ray, because when I read that about the calabash, I thought, oh, that's what medieval pilgrims
carried. Did they?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yes. And so sometimes even today, the pilgrims who walk the medieval pilgrimage route, the older pilgrims. I mean, nowadays we have water thermoses, water bottles, but but that's what the medieval pilgrims carried, a gourd for their for their water.
Well, it's a great way to carry water. Water is heavy stuff, as you know, and the gourds, once you hollow them out, are quite light. And so it's a perfect way to carry water. That's interesting, Nancy. I didn't know that. Well, it's just another parallel.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, these fellows went down south, and they found Hua Kai Shan, and they lived there. And there are temples all over these mountains today dedicated to the two perfected lords is what they called them, because they had lived in the natural world so long that they had attained wisdom and insight. And so the two perfected lords were so much like John Muir, and they traveled light. They didn't carry packs and overcoats and blankets. They botanized on the way. They gathered medicinal plants as they went on their pilgrimage to this mountain, to these mountains. And just as people in China today talk about the two perfected lords as they go to these mountains, just the same way that people today, when they go to Yosemite, talk about John Muir. And the interesting thing is that neither Muir nor the two perfected lords were legends or myths, I should say. They were real people who had attained something special by all their time in the natural world, and that was recognized. And we still remember about John Muir 100 and some years later, and the two perfected lords are remembered 1,000 years later. But it's extremely similar to my mind at any rate. And to me, that's intriguing, this similarity between characters in the Taoist tradition and John Muir.
And you actually went to China yourself and climbed up on a mountain dawn.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, dawn is when you get up. Dawn is when the flow of energy is at its...
Qi.
Yeah, thank you. The Qi, as they call it, is at its strongest. And so me and some... buddies were on Omeishan in Sichuan, and we had climbed the mountain. We were the only ones carrying our own backpacks up the mountains. All the Chinese had enough sense to hire 11 and 12-year-old girls to carry their gear for them up the mountains. And old ladies would hire young peasant boys to carry them on palanquins up the mountain, up the top of the mountain, if they couldn't make it themselves. Anyway, we all got to the top of the mountain, and you get up before dawn, and they had these bulky coats on the back of the doors of the rooms of the hostel. We call them Mao coats because it was pretty cold that early in the morning. And so people by the hundreds would be streaming to the top of Omeishan to see the dawn. And it was just a lot of fun, and everyone was in a fine mood. And the sun came up, and typically it's hidden behind some clouds at any rate. So it's a little anticlimactic. But then after the sunrise and everyone's got all that qi energy, they go back to the refectory and eat congee, rice gruel, and pickled vegetables. And it's a wonderful way to spend the morning.
My guest is retired Professor Ray Barnett, and he taught in the biology department at Chico State for 30 years. He has now written a book, Earth Wisdom, John Muir, Accidental Taoist, Charts Humanity's Only Future on a Changing Planet. And you mentioned that Muir, there are all these Taoist aspects to Muir's worldview. And you also mentioned that Galen Cart said, well, if I'm going to only live a year, I'm going to go someplace beautiful. And I wanted to ask you about John Muir's concept of God, because so often in the book, God is equated with beauty.
Yes.
And all the more astounding, when I read what John Muir's father did to him, my gosh, we wouldn't tolerate that these days.
No, I mean, he was abused physically at any rate. I mean, his father was extremely fundamentalistic, Calvinist, Scotch, Presbyterian sort of, although you wouldn't call him Presbyterian, but he was very fundamentalist in the Calvinist mold. And he was very exacting. John was his oldest son, and the father moved the whole family to Wisconsin and had all of his sons. From Scotland to Wisconsin.
John Muir came when he was 12 years old, you
yes,
say.
Yes, right. He was an immigrant. And and his father would sit in the log cabin they had built at the front window reading his Bible, watching John work. And John worked while there was light. You know, if it was 10 hours or 8 hours in the winter or 14 hours in the summer, and his father would watch John. And he required John to learn the Bible by verse by verse. And so Muir often said that he had learned the entire New Testament and 2/3 of the Old Testament by sore flesh. Which is to say, whenever he made a mistake in reciting any Bible verse his father asked him about, his father would hit him. with a switch or a stick. And so,
virtually whipping if he made a mistake in a Bible verse.
In a Bible verse, and even more so if he wasn't working hard enough during the day in his father's estimation. So, Muir was literally beaten by his dad most days between the time he had moved to Wisconsin and the time he finally got away from his home when he was, I think, 24, something like that. And, you know, to us it sounds horrible, and doubtless it is and was horrible, but it was not uncommon back then for this sort of thing to happen in homes that had a strongly patriarchal sort of aspect to them. And Muir, incredibly to me, was not particularly resentful. He certainly didn't raise his kids that way, but he didn't hate his father. It didn't make him into a monster. Muir was an exceedingly sunny fellow, full of life, and to me that's marvelous. And when his dad died, Muir came all the way back to be with his father on his deathbed, and he honored and respected his father, even though his father had abused him. And that's one of the strange things about Muir. I don't see how he did it, but he did. He was very respectful of both his father and his mother, and Muir himself was a wonderful father to his two daughters. The meals were always riotous affairs, and Muir would make up verses, doggerel verses, and then require or ask his daughters to make up verses, and his daughters would demand that Muir would tell them the latest installment in the Paddy Grogan stories, and this was a kangaroo from Australia that he just made up stories about this kangaroo. And his oldest daughter, Helen, said, quote, "Father was the jolliest child of us all." And so this was the kind of person Muir turned out to be somehow.
Well, so his father had this very strict religion, and John Muir, though, did not share his father's concept of God in the least. That is interesting, too, that you'd think, well, the New Testament is a little less strict, maybe is the word, but he didn't talk about Jesus writings.
No, he didn't. You know, it's interesting. His first, say, 6 months or so out of his homestead, in his journal, he does mention God more often. But then as he is on his 1,000-mile walk to the Gulf, he has his eyes wide open and his mind is wide open too. And he quickly, on this 1,000-mile walk, and his journal on this walk is published now as a separate book, The 1,000-Mile Walk to the Gulf, he comes to incredible insights just through an open mind and using his eyes. And he realizes that, geez, our concept of God looks an awful lot like a white European male who's in favor of a republic or a limited monarchy. And he quickly sees that our concept of God is modeled after humans in his eyes. And he says, you know, looking at the rest of creation, clearly God loved the rest of creation as much as he loves us. Why should we think that God looks like a human rather than a snake or an alligator? And that's one very important aspect of what I call his worldview that he came to rather quickly on his first big saunter out in the world by himself. He replaced his father's anthropocentric point of view, a human-centered point of view, a God that looks and acts like an angry father. He replaced that with what I have called the Gaia-centric worldview, and that is a worldview that says the center of the earth is not humans, but rather the center of the earth is the earth as a whole, and that all of the creatures on the earth are as dear to God as we are. In fact, he even goes further than that. He says the other creatures on the planet are unfallen and undepraved, and by that he means only one creature of those that God made messed up and had to be saved. All the rest of the creatures are still in good shape. And so that's rather radical, and it's what makes Muir, I think, stand out and makes his worldview unique and different in the Western tradition.
So when he uses the word God, which he does often, he doesn't mean the same thing other people might mean by that term.
By no means.
So I want to ask you then, was John Muir a Taoist?
Well, that's a good question. I would not just call him flat out a Taoist, because of course the Taoist tradition is extraordinarily rich. It's a 3,000-year-old tradition in China. And Muir sort of stumbled upon the same point of view, the same way of looking at the world, but he was a Scotch immigrant. And so that's why I call him an accidental Taoist. But I do think it's quite accurate to say that the worldview of Earth Wisdom, Muir's worldview, is congruent in virtually every respect with the worldview of the Taoist tradition developed half a world away over thousands of years. And to me, that's quite remarkable. And today, that point of view could be quite handy in our current ecological crisis as well.
Well, John Muir, we know of him, and we are grateful, I think, most of us, for his legacy. So what is his legacy?
Well, to my mind, Nancy, he has two legacies. One is his worldview, Earth Wisdom. It's a very unique worldview. It's a coherent worldview. I mean, again, as we've had people, Heraclitus and Albert Schweitzer and Alexander von Humboldt and St. Francis, who have parts of it, but only Muir put it together. So that's one legacy. The other legacy, of course, is the environmental movement. He founded the Sierra Club, and he was very important to the entire environmental movement that developed in the late 1800s and early 1900s. So those two legacies are, I mean, either one would be fine, but those two legacies are extremely important, I think, as we struggle with the problems that we've created in the last half century here on the Earth.
So I think this is a perfect time to read your book about John Muir, learn things we didn't know today on his birthday. Thank you so much, Ray.
You're welcome, Nancy. It's been a pleasure to be here.
My guest has been Raymond Barnett. His newest book is Earth Wisdom, about John Muir. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.